From the Sky News Centre at 5. The government is denying that shares in Royal Mail were undervalued. They ended the day priced around a third higher than where they started. It was conditional trading today between institutional investors ahead of a full listing on Tuesday. The 500-year-old company's value has risen by around £1 billion. Labour leader Ed Miliband claims the government got its sums wrong.
Well, I think it's pretty clear now that this was a fire sale of a great British institution at a knockdown price, and I don't think that's good value for money for the taxpayer, and I don't think it's good value for money for the customers of Royal Mail.
Two bodies have been discovered in the back garden of a house near Mansfield. Police say there may have been what's described as an incident there in the late 1990s. The main political parties have reportedly reached agreement on a proposed royal charter to establish a new system of press regulation. It's thought Labour has agreed to a series of changes put forward by Culture Secretary Maria Miller. It'll now go forward to the Privy Council for final agreement at the end of the month. The group overseeing the destruction of chemical weapons in Syria has won the Nobel Peace Prize.
The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, for its extensive work for eliminating chemical weapons.
There were a record 259 nominees for this year's prize, including Malala Yousafzai. The Pakistani schoolgirl was treated in Birmingham after being shot in the head by the Taliban, who objected to her campaign for girls' education. Firefighters in England and Wales are to stage another strike in their row with the government over pensions. The Fire Brigades Union says its members will walk out for 5 hours from 6:30 next Saturday evening. And it could be a tense night at Wembley, where England take on Montenegro in World Cup qualifying. Roy Hodgson's side know a win this evening, followed by a victory over Poland on Tuesday, would see them through to Brazil. The Republic of Ireland have to beat Germany to stand any chance of making it to the tournament. That's the very latest from Sky. I'm Andy Hayes.
Love Bristol.
Love.
BCFM 93.2.
Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Southville and leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, Tess Green. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the biggest local story you haven't heard about. Conservative Defence Secretary Philip Hammond wants to sell off Abbeywood Defence Equipment and Support, where 7,000 local people work, an MOD procurement. So the defence industry will be awarding contracts to themselves, and we'll be paying. Top it all, the deal will probably go to a US defence contractor. We're joined by independent and Evening Standard journalist Mark Leftley, who's been following what's one of the most controversial government proposals at all at the moment. Plus, Daphne Havercroft from Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group returns to report on how NHS privatisation is going. We have Martin Summer's weekly tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs of 13, mainly cloudy. Weekend with plenty of drizzle. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius, a mixture of sunshine and showers, getting slightly warmer as the week progresses. Next weekend, 19th and 20th of October, highs around 16 still, sunshine and showers next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Southville and leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, Tess Green. Hi, Tess. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony.
First of all, give us an idea of how many Green councillors you've got now and what your role is as leader of the party.
Okay, well, I'm not actually leader anymore.
Aren't you?
Because I've just handed over to Daniela Radici. I had been leader for the last two and a half years or so, and it was time for somebody else to have a crack at that. There are four of us now, Tony. When I started off, I was the sole Green councillor. And then the year after, we got Gus Hoyt elected. Gus is now on the cabinet, And then we got last May two more Green councillors. So we're rapidly increasing and we intend to carry on doing that.
So what's at the heart of the Green vision for your party for the city?
We'd like people to be much more aware of the environmental costs of the growth that we think we need to actually continue to extend the city.
What do you mean you think we think we need? Because we do need that growth in order to provide jobs.
Well, we need the right kind of growth. This is why it's the grey area creeps in. We need jobs in renewable energy, in green transport. We need jobs to provide our food as near as possible to the city to reduce our carbon footprint. We need all those jobs that will help us to use less energy in the future.
Well, I've got two things to say to that. One is cars and the other is supermarkets. So how on earth are you going to break the power of the cars and the oil industry, and how are you going to break the power of the supermarkets? I would have thought that's almost impossible task you've set yourself there.
I think it is a very difficult task, but I think the mayor is on our side, at least as far as the car is concerned. I think the residents' parking schemes are the very first shot. We could go on to have a congestion scheme, congestion area for Bristol, that we shouldn't just continue to suffer the ill effects of the motor car in our city, with congestion, with pollution, with the dangerous state of some of the roads. I think we do need to do something about it. And similarly with supermarkets, I think we start acknowledging that local shops actually employ many more people than supermarkets do, in proportion to their sales, often have suppliers who can supply from very nearby, so have very low miles for their food or whatever it is they sell, much more so than the supermarkets. And so actually there's no competition when it comes to environmental effect. We should be promoting independent, small, local shops. And we need to break the monopoly stranglehold of the supermarkets.
Well, you can promote them all you want, but small shops are dying. The supermarkets are taking over. As people's pockets become smaller, you know, in terms of their food bill, they're looking for somewhere that's not going to cost them so much. They're going to go to Aldi or somewhere like that, even if necessary. There's really no way that these small local shops can survive, certainly not in an urban area.
Well, they do in my area. You ask the small shopkeepers in Southville, but it's actually taken a concerted drive to get to that position where the local shops are actually supported. We've got the Bristol Pound now, and that helps to keep money in the local economy. There are measures we can take which don't advantage the supermarkets and do advantage the small independent shops.
Well, I may be a bit naive, but I've not seen these Bristol Pounds being exchanged in Morrison's or anywhere like, you know, the Tesco's or anywhere like that. So will they accept those?
No, we don't want them to. The whole point of the Bristol Pound is that it keeps money in the Bristol economy. The supermarkets don't do that. Their profits go to shareholders who could be anywhere in the world. They go out of Bristol. We want to keep the money here.
As someone that's obviously following what's happening with the Bristol Pound, I mean, how's it going in Southville and Bedminster, places like that? Are people actually, is it starting to circulate as cash? Is it useful for, I mean, buying other things, such as, for example, paying your council tax bill, that kind of stuff?
Yes, that's coming. People can be paid. People who work for the council and some other firms can be paid in Bristol Pounds if they choose or have part of their pay. It's one of these initiatives which is bedding down, and people like it. People like the idea that the money they have to pay for things actually stays in the local economy.
Okay, also the car business. I mean, you know, it's all very well having this residence parking, but that's the stick approach. What about the carrot? What about actually decent public transport, so people actually want to get on a bus or a train to come into work in the mornings?
Yes, I couldn't agree more that we can't just have the stick. We need the carrot, and we do need to tackle public transport. We need to tackle it in a variety of ways, and I think we've got a very clear vision of how we do that. And one of the things we desperately need is a transport hub, so that people who arrive by train, by bus, by even by ferry, or on foot and by bike, can all arrive at one place where they transfer to another mode of transport safely, where they're not frightened to wait if it's late at night, and where it's obvious where the transport will go from. That's one thing. The other thing is that we need to make use of our rail lines that aren't being used at the moment around the city, which could provide the basis for a metro, which would be away from the streets. They wouldn't be subjected to the congestion on our roads that the buses have to cope with. And we need to make sure that we have a decent bus network and that the cost is affordable. All of those things need to be tackled. I think we've started. If the Greens were in power, these things would be done a lot more quickly. But we have to work with what we've got.
What about, I mean, because the thing is, for years we say the same things on here. Everyone says, oh, we want public transport to be better. But what practical measures have you got as Greens to actually say, well, that would actually either reduce fares, extend the bus network or the train network and get people actually using public transport? Because it's something that politicians always talk about but very rarely actually act on.
Well, that's true. And the use of the rail lines is one obvious thing that we could do quicker than we're going to. We should have done it years ago because we have got the basis of a good way of moving around Bristol in the rail track that's already there. It needs very little done to it to make it effective. And then we need to reorganise the buses so that they feed in to the rail stations as well as coming into the city centre, which is what they do now. As to making it cheaper, I think the only way we could really do that is to take back the control of buses into public control.
OK, tell us a bit about you, Tess. What got you interested in politics and why the Greens?
Well, I've been, you probably know, Tony, I've been a trade unionist for years, and so I've been interested in employment rights issues.
In which union?
I was a member of Unison, still am. So that was one part of it. I was a member of the Labour Party as well for years, but I'm afraid when Tony Blair got elected, I started to get very disillusioned and had to leave.
But weren't you cheering in the 1997 election as a Labour Party member? Tony Blair is suddenly in charge of the country. Surely it's time to break open the champagne.
Well, yes, a lot of people thought so. Unfortunately, what I'd seen of Tony Blair led me to think that he was a fraudster and that he would not lead the party in the way that I could possibly approve of, and I think I was proved right, and I think a lot of Labour Party members would now say yes, you know, we wish we hadn't had Tony Blair because he's done a lot of damage to the socialist ideals of Labour. So I had to leave the Labour Party, and it's when you've been in a party for most of your long working life, that's actually quite difficult. And it took me a while to recover from that and then to realise actually one of the things that annoyed me about the Labour Party was the fact that they were not taking environmental concerns seriously and that my natural home would be with the Greens.
OK, so what do you make of Ed Miliband now? Ever any thoughts about rejoining Labour? Because, I mean, most people will say he's not cut from the same cloth as Tony Blair.
I agree with that, and I'm quite pleased with the turn of events that the Labour Party seems to be taking, but I'm not convinced. I mean, one person is not going to make that amount of difference. They've got a huge amount of backlog to make up before I could be convinced at all that they're the party to support.
OK, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Before we hear from Prime Minister's questions, they're back again, by the way, after the party conference season, after their long summer break. The Prime Minister's now got to get his grilling once a week, every Wednesday. Martin, what's your thoughts about the recent policy changes by Ed Miliband after the conference, doing things like coming out saying, well, we're going to be roll back the bedroom tax if we take power? It seems like he's almost a changed man, whereas before the party conference we were seeing quite a lot of criticism of Ed Miliband. It seems now that maybe he's getting in his swing a little bit. Anyway, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I broadly agree with what's been said. I think he's starting to make some steps to make up for the new Labour era when Labour lost its way. People have got to understand, though, that if you're going to win a national election in Britain at the moment under the completely unfair electoral system we have got, there are constraints on anybody who's the leader of the Labour Party. Basically, you have to win in the marginal constituencies surrounding London, which means that in actual fact, what you can get away with and what you can actually say is quite limited.
You've got to win in Kettering.
Yeah, well, it's places like Basildon and Harlow. And that, of course, means that most of the electorate are disenfranchised. For example, you know, the inner city electorate in Bristol really doesn't count for anything very much.
But they've got votes.
Well, yes, but the point is that under the current electoral system, it is a two-way fight between Labour and the Conservatives, with the Liberals as spoilers, if you like. It's a silly system. I mean, if we had a proper proportional system, as they've had in Ireland since 1920 or Denmark since the 1940s, then there wouldn't actually be such a tension around this. But unfortunately, we are playing under a completely unfair system. And that's why sometimes some of the things that the Labour leadership does are seem incomprehensible to many of their own supporters. But I think they're trapped by the system.
One of the things that New Labour did try and do was to privatise the Royal Mail. Didn't succeed. Lord Mandelson had a go and failed. But the Business Secretary, Vince Cable, has succeeded. And it's all happened today. Now, first of all, Martin, what is an IPO?
Well, it's a share issue, basically. I mean, I don't know what the exact IPO stands for, but it basically means selling shares, an offer of some sort.
Okay. Well, today the value, the spike immediately after the stock exchange opened, meant that the values of these shares that people bought went up more than 30%, literally within seconds. It boosted the value of the company to more than $4.5 billion, up from the pre-flotation pricing of $3.3 billion. Well, that's about a third more. Hang on a minute. I mean, just do my sums here. That's at £1.2 billion more it's worth now than it was this morning. What's going on?
Well, they suggest that there was £28 billion worth of bids for the what is it, 1.5, or you know, a small number of billions of shares. So that was way oversubscribed.
Well, originally 3.3 billion of shares, which leapt immediately to 4.5 billion.
There were £28 billion worth of potential bids put in. In other words, it's being flogged off cheap to the Conservative Party's chums in the city, and they're going to make money out of it, and some small people will make money too. But of course, you've got to have a minimum of £750 to participate in this freebie. And of course, most people in this country have more than half the people in this country have no savings at all. So of course, they're not going to be included in this.
Tess, what are your thoughts about this today, Royal Mail being sold off? Because it does seem like it's just free money for anyone that's got £1,000 or more of savings. It's just a bit of free money for them. In a way, a kind of bribe to say, well, look, do this and you get some free money, and you're participating in the sell-off of Royal Mail.
Yeah, I agree with you, Tony, that and we shouldn't be doing this. We shouldn't be allowing it to happen. The Royal Mail is a public service, or it has been, which we all depend on, and we don't need it to be in private hands. And the only reason it's going into private hands is to make more money for those who've already got enough. It certainly won't benefit anybody who's got a difficult delivery address, or people who need the kind of reliable service that we get from the Royal Mail now.
Now, 150,000 Royal Mail staff each get around £2,200 worth of free shares, but they do have to hold on to them for a period of 5 years. Do you think that there's a certain amount of sense in this, Martin, that actually the people who are working for Royal Mail, mostly members of the Communication Workers Union, they're actually given £2,200 effectively each for free in order to participate in this?
Well, they themselves will say that we're being bribed, and I understand several hundred of the staff have refused to accept the shares. But I mean, basically, who can afford to turn down free money? Most people working for the company have decided they're going to accept the shares. What people have got to realise is that the pension fund, which is basically in arrears, has been left in the hands of the public sector. So basically, if the whole thing had been sold as a proper package, as a private company would be, then it wouldn't really have made any money at all, because there's a pension shortfall because the managers didn't pay into the pension fund in the good years. Now, in other words, the government, that is to say the taxpayer, that is to say the rest of us, will pick up that bill. We could have used the profits from Royal Mail to help offset that, but those are now going into private pockets. And the whole, and coming back to the Labour Party, I mean, the Labour Party encouraged this. What they could have done, and the Labour conference actually passed a motion, I understand it, to say that they should re-nationalise the Royal Mail, which would, of course, have scuppered the sale. But the Labour leadership said, no, we can't do that. That would be irresponsible. Now, this is where I do take issue with the Labour leadership, because if you were to say you were going to renationalise it, you would have scuppered the sale, it would have shot down one of the government's leading policies, and then everything would have started to run in the other direction. So that when Ed Miliband, for example, said he was going to put a price cap on the energy utilities, their shares fell. And their shares fell because people who buy shares realise that Labour is going to win the next election, and therefore they started to price that in as soon as they realised that Miliband was prepared to do that. And of course that then puts the skids under Cameron. The bookies shorten the odds on a Labour victory. Now if Labour had a real killer instinct, that's what they'd do, is they'd start blocking Tory measures, making the government look as if it was like losing control, and therefore winning the argument. But what we've got to do in the Labour Party, what we've got to deal with in the Labour Party, is a fifth column of people who are basically pro-privatisation, and that includes Lord Mandelson. He shouldn't be anywhere near the front bench, by the way.
Just looking at the undervaluing of this Royal Mail, it's roughly something like £100 per family test that everyone has lost, or at least the taxpayer has lost, the country has lost, by undervaluing it in the way they did this morning when the prices leapt. So, I mean, how does that actually impact on anybody? I mean, surely they could have just dished out that £100 to every single family in the country, and that would have been some sort of help.
Of course they could. Yeah, we're losing service and we're paying more.
Yes, a great pity. It's almost a sort of, I think it was Henry VIII set up Royal Mail those years ago. I mean, ultimately, the other thing that strikes me about this, Martin, is every time something else is privatised, that vote we do every 4 years or 5 years, or even in the local elections, counts for less, doesn't it?
That's right. I mean, at local government level, what power does local government now have? And it's quite right when people turn around and say, well, what difference does it make? It doesn't. What they want to do is create a market state, which is just minimal, basically involved really with repressing people who protest against the state's behaviour. And therefore, it doesn't matter who you elect, you can't direct, all of these institutions are no longer directed by the by.
I mean, they're constantly moaning, aren't they, saying, people don't vote, they must vote, they should vote, but they're actually making those votes worth less and less. So, Tess, who's really running things? If you guys at the city council are having less and less power, you know, a lot of the things that we need in the city are outsourced, you know, the council has got less control of them, and the same with the country. So who's running things if the elected politicians aren't able to?
It's the rich companies and the rich individuals that are running the country, and the sooner that we try and do something about that, the better.
Do what?
We have to get rid of that system. We have to encourage democracy, proper democracy. This isn't democracy. The way we elect our governments and our local authorities is not a democratic way of doing things. We need to change that. We need proportional representation. We need it quickly so that people actually will feel that it is worth voting again, worth taking an interest in local politics and in national politics again, and that their voice will actually be heard.
Well, that PR idea, I mean, it was a referendum about it at the time of the last election. It looks like it was kicked out. It doesn't look like that's going to be happening anytime soon. That was a move towards proportional representation, and the public seemed to reject it, didn't they?
Well, there's powerful forces against it, and people are very susceptible to the kind of advertising they're subjected to. That's the problem. People aren't analytical. I think, you know, part of the reason lies with the schools, the kind of teaching that students get. They don't actually learn to analyse things. They take things on face value, and they get conned a lot of the time.
Well, a lot of it's just simple marketing, the amount of marketing money thrown at one side or the other in these discussions. Anyway, one story that's popped up this week, which I know is quite close to your heart, Tess, is blacklisting victims to be given recourse to compensation by 8 major building firms. This is in yesterday's Daily Mirror. The firms, including Balfour Beatty and Carillion, issued a joint apology, but the other 36 implicated are yet to follow suit. Workers illegally blacklisted from jobs on building sites will finally get compensation from some of the biggest firms in the construction industry. The 3,213 victims whose names were kept on a secret industry blacklist. The surprise move comes just days before a legal action in the High Court in London to seek justice and compensation for 100 workers blacklisted from the union for their union activity or raising health and safety issues on building sites. Campaigners said the court action will still go ahead, and the firms were trying to deflect attention to protect their reputations as new evidence of the extent of blacklisting would be presented to the judges. So tell us about the motion you brought to the City Council here, Tess, what that was about and what happened.
Right, because we're aware of this blacklisting, and it has been going on a long time, and you've only talked about the tip of the iceberg, really, the 44 companies that the Information Commissioner's Office found to be using blacklists were just one lot of companies. There's a whole lot more that do the same. Those companies use blacklists so that they can avoid employing people who might raise health and safety concerns or other fairness and justice or even environmental concerns at work, because it's cheaper for them if they have a docile workforce who don't pay attention to that sort of thing, and they don't actually care about the safety of their workers. So that's the bottom line that we need to be paying attention to. The fact that the Information Commissioner did seize the records and expose what was going on in 44 companies is just the start. And the fact that the companies are trying to cobble together a scheme, which only 8 of them have actually signed up to, for compensation and apology to the workers who were affected, means that they're really just trying to deflect the attention from the real core of the problem. And I think this is part of the whole attack on trade unions that began certainly in the Thatcher's years, and probably a bit earlier than that actually, where people were discouraged from joining trade unions. They were discouraged from joining together to make sure they had decent conditions at work. And we're still suffering from that, and people are still scared. And people did know about these blacklists. I've got a friend who was convinced he was on a blacklist. After he was made redundant, he failed to get another job, even though he was often, or at least twice, offered jobs, and then when they looked at the references, he didn't get it. And he thinks that's the reason, because he was a trade union activist.
Well, because it's all secret, the thing is that people might point at you and say, well, you're paranoid, you're just no good.
Well, that's the trouble. And because it's secret, even though the Information Commissioner has got this list of names of workers who are on the blacklist, and 25 of them, I think, actually were Bristol workers, those people are not being notified that they're on that list. They don't know that they're on the list. They may have their suspicions, like my friend has, that they must have been blacklisted because of what happened to them.
Well, you know what this reminds me of is the phone hacking, because there was a list of something like 3,000 people who'd had their phones hacked. Same exact situation. The police had the list, but they weren't actually telling the people who were on the list that they were on the list, because, of course, then there may be legal action against the people that were doing the hacking in the first place. Really, actually, you would have thought that the police's duty there was to actually, and with the Information Commissioner, to immediately notify anybody if they're on a blacklist. Well, the eight firms, sorry to interrupt you, but the eight firms said in a statement, the companies Balfour Beatty, Carillion, Costain, Keir, Lang, O'Rourke, Sir Robert McAlpine, Skanska UK and Vinci PLC all apologised for their involvement with the Consulting Association, which was the company that held this list, and the impact that its database may have had on any individual construction worker. Now, that's interesting, isn't it? Because Keir is on there. Now, we had Deputy Leader of the Conservatives, Mark Weston, on the other day, actually saying, well, he doesn't think there's any evidence that Keir were doing it. Well, they've come out themselves now and said that they were.
They've admitted it. And we know that several companies on that list were actually receiving contracts from Bristol City Council. And so we're complicit. That makes us complicit in this human rights abuse of workers. And it's not just the abuse of the actual workers who are on the list. It's the fear that it puts into all the other workers who won't step forward to report dangerous conditions at work or inhumane conditions at work because of this. So it actually affects everybody. And the sooner we get to grips with it in a much more realistic way than this, the better. I don't think we should accept that this is a victory at all.
Martin, this goes back a long way, doesn't it? Yeah. To the 70s, the Economic League, I think Caprim, several other companies that have held these blacklists, some connected with the security services, MI5, and getting information from sometimes from police files and from people's security service files.
Yeah, well, there's one of the undercover police officers that was in the special demonstration squad says that he thinks that he collected information on people who were on this blacklist, so the police were being used to collect the information and then passing it to the companies. Yeah. That should be not just a sackable offence, that should be a criminal offence. And I think it's the Welsh Assembly that started this, didn't they, saying that companies which are shown to have engaged in these practices should not be eligible to bid for any public sector contracts.
Well, at the very, very least, it's data protection, isn't it? I mean, if the police are collecting something for a police database and people then start selling that information or sharing it on, then that's the data protection.
Well, I mean, we know this stuff has been going on for years. It's now coming out. But I think we've got to make it stick. I mean, basically, I would say that none of these companies should be eligible for any kind of of public contracts, and that opens the door to all sorts of other companies.
So how will that work? Let's have competition. With Kier, for example, Kier have got a massive contract with the city council, isn't that, with the cleaning? I mean, how, now you've passed the motion of the council, what's going to happen with that contract?
Well, that contract has to be examined. I mean, I think it's fairly weak, really, because it does depend how rigorously the examination is of their employment practices. If there's evidence that they're blacklisting, then I think the contract could be terminated. But it's very difficult to do that legally under procurement law. We're in a better position as a council, where we're looking at new contracts and firms that we haven't already contracted with, and looking at their employment record.
Now, hang on a minute. This is one of the reasons why this privatisation is such a bad idea. Even if halfway through a contract you decide, right, these people are a bunch of crooks, we don't want to deal with them anymore, they will come back to you with their lawyers and say, sorry, you've got to deal with us. In fact, they won't say sorry, will they? They will say tough.
Yes, they will. And so the legal position is very difficult for us to negotiate, and it will be costly as well. So I'm not sure how seriously councils can take this, but I do think that because Bristol City Council and a number of other authorities did pass that kind of motion to look at their contracts very carefully and not to give contracts to blacklisting companies if they could avoid it, I think that was quite powerful, and I think it was the least we could do to actually try and make a difference there. There's a lot more that we need to do.
Okay, this is a construction blacklist, Martin. What about other blacklists? I mean, there may well be others out there.
Well, there may well be, and of course we have got a creeping police state in this country. We've had it for many, many years. Those who have been active on the left, like present company, will be aware that we've been aware for a very long time that this goes on, and that, you know, basically people who speak out are in fact persecuted in this country. We've got to do something about it.
Well, the place where this is all supposed to happen is Westminster, isn't it? And the Houses of Parliament. And they're back this week. So I'm sure you'll be you'll be really looking forward to this, Martin. Prime Minister's Questions back. And we've got Ed Miliband asking some questions of David Cameron, the Labour leader of the Conservative Prime Minister, about people's money in their pocket and also energy prices.
Mr. Speaker, he said something very interesting. He said he doesn't want to talk about an economic policy. He wants to talk about the cost of living. Now, doesn't that say it all? He doesn't realise that an economic policy is about the cost of living and what hundreds of thousands, millions of families are facing in this country. Whatever you say about him, he's true to form. We have a cost of living crisis in this country. Energy bills are rising, and he supports the energy companies, not the consumer. We have a Prime Minister who always stands up for the wrong people.
But we know what his cost of living policy is. It is more spending, more borrowing, and more debt. And that would lead to higher taxes and higher mortgage rates. That is the double whammy that would hit every family in this country. But not only have I got the birthday present of the Shadow Chancellor staying in post, and incidentally also the birthday present of the Shadow Health Secretary staying in post, I also have this special birthday treat, which is the Shadow Chancellor yesterday revealed their election campaign. He said it all depended on the two of them together because, and I quote, and I'm not making this up, they would win because of their experience, their track record, and their credibility.
Well, not a lot of actual real sense there. Of course, he didn't answer the real question, which is really to do with the cost of living. But Martin, what about Labour policy? Spending and debt, that's what Mr Cameron is saying that Labour are going to be doing.
Well, I mean, in actual fact, Osborne himself has now admitted that we're only going to get the deficit down over the medium term, which is frankly what the Labour front bench has been saying from the very beginning. So in actual fact, what's happened, having lost our AAA credit rating, they are now admitting that the deficit will only be got down according to...
Well, he's saying by 2020.
Yes, but that's pretty much what Alistair Darling was saying at the last election anyway. So in other words, we've gone all the way around the houses to end up where we started, apart from the fact that we've lost... lots and lots of growth that we might have had. We might have lost our AAA credit rating anyway, but we would have kept the economy growing. We've actually stalled the economy and lost our AAA credit rating, and we're only going to get the deficit down in the medium term. and basically they're trying to bluff it. I don't think there's any easy answers, because of course the real problem, the Labour front bench haven't got this, is that there's a real possibility of a banking collapse like 2008. If the Republicans carry on digging their heels in the US this week, it's quite possible, but by next Friday we'll have seen a stock market crash which will blow everything out of the water, and we'll all be going back to square one. So all of the mainstream political parties are talking as if the economy is just about
Martin, is not helping that, is it? Because you've got people now going out there getting 95% mortgages. Now, this is rather like the old subprime crisis in the United States, which caused this whole thing in the first place, supposedly.
Well, it is, although it doesn't seem to be, in actual fact, it doesn't actually seem to be working. The help-to-buy scheme doesn't seem to be actually, you know, there's not...
A lot of people are taking it up. This is what I'm
hearing. They're not actually getting deals which are very much better than they would have otherwise got. But in actual fact, of course, the point is that at the same time, we're giving free shares to those who've got £750 and more, and of course for big institutional shareholders. We're giving subsidised mortgages to those who have, many of whom have already got houses, and many bankers are going to trade up, I understand. I was reading some gossip amongst bankers in the city saying they're going to use Help to Buy to trade up because they like that kind of speculative investment. Meanwhile, the people at the bottom of the pile are being blacklisted, kicked out of their houses, and having their benefits cut. Especially, and they're talking now about everybody under 25 having no benefits at all. So it's back to Victorian era then. And there we go. That's what we're looking at.
Tess, what about the main issue being discussed in the Commons there, this business of basically the amount of money people have got to spend, energy prices going up, a lot of people there now working all the hours God sends and still can't pay the bills.
Yeah, I mean, that's the real nub of it. It's how people can work all the hours there are, some people, with two or three part-time jobs, and they still can't make ends meet. And they're actually being demonised in the press, that the poor are responsible for their own misery. This is the message that we get, when it's completely untrue. They're being punished. I mean, the benefit cuts are really obnoxious, and we should be standing up and rebelling against that kind of thing. The bedroom tax, so-called bedroom tax under occupancy, where people are being punished because they so say have one more bedroom than they really need, they're trying to force them to move into other accommodation. They're not counting the costs of that to the local authority or the housing associations, which inevitably is a huge cost. And the very fact is that we don't have the accommodation to move people into so that they can avoid this extra loss of benefit. It is an attack on the poorest in our community. The fact that we're being forced as local authorities to get rid of many of our staff because we can't afford to pay them anymore because of the government allowances, that is another attack on the poorest in our communities.
Well, in the Independent Day, we've got the Red Cross launching an emergency food aid plan for the UK's hungry. The Red Cross is this winter starting collecting and distributing food aid to the needy in Britain for the first time since the Second World War, whereas Martin, in over in Switzerland, they're doing a referendum on a £1,800 annual citizens' income, which is a Green Party thing.
Not an annual, it's a monthly.
Sorry, monthly. Did I say annual?
Yes, no, it's a monthly. I think this idea of citizens' income in Cyprus also, they've talked about it. I believe it's been a Green policy for many years.
It has.
I mean, what we need to do is to see the Labour Party won't talk about these kind of things because of the electoral system.
Yeah.
They see themselves locked trying to win these marginal seats where they've got to be seen to be on the Tory agenda, as it were, about overspending on benefits. Now, in actual fact, you think of the macroeconomics of cutting benefits and wages for poor people, it actually makes the economy go down. What you really need to do is actually boost the spending power of the poorest. That's actually a key.
But it's all very easy to say, but where on earth did the Swiss, I mean, maybe they get it from some sort of Smaug-like gold mine underneath Switzerland somewhere, but, you know, how on earth do they find £1,800 per month for every single person in the country
and
give it to them for free?
This has all been costed out over many years. The original conception of a citizen's income was thought up by Milton Friedman, who called it negative income tax. And in actual fact, you see, everybody who buys a house is getting mortgage tax relief, for example. you abolish that. And the beauty of a citizen's income as well is that you don't have to means test it. So things like housing benefit, for example, has to be constantly recalculated every time people get an extra couple of hours work or whatever. Whereas the thing about a citizen's income is if you're on the list, you get the money. And of course, you could really copper bottom it by saying everybody over 16 gets the money, perhaps, or 18, as long as they vote in proportional representation in elections. So you can link the payment to actually getting more of a turnout.
But Tess, the city are never going to allow that here, even if it was passed through the House of Commons. I mean, you can't imagine the city saying, okay, we'll cough up however much it is you need to give everybody the money.
No, I mean, that's why we need a different system. I think if you ask people out there on the whole if they'd like a fairer system and that to be underpinned by a citizen's income, people would agree with it because it makes absolute sense. It means that people can undertake voluntary work, training, looking after other people in their family or whatever, and still be able to pay their bills. It gives everybody a sense of security.
Yeah, it's just peace of mind underlying that. That then helps the confidence factor. This is why Cyprus is actually in more of an economic crisis than Switzerland. Switzerland's probably got the resources to do this without thinking about it too much. Cyprus having an economic crisis, but even so, it makes sense. Because if you give people the security they know they're going to be all right, then people can settle down and start to make plans. Yeah. At the moment, they can't make any plans because they don't know how they're going to get through next
week. Well, Sybil Edmonds on her Boiling Frogs blog, boilingfrogs.info, is saying, will the basic income revolution come from Switzerland? I mean, she's saying, well, look, this is happening in Cyprus, it's happening in Switzerland too. Is it just a matter of time before most of the Western world has to do
it? The Grillisti in Italy are also demanding it, who hold the balance of power in the Italian parliament, or they would hold the balance of power if they were prepared to cooperate. They're not.
But then
the crisis itself eventually forces the solutions forward. But our system is so corrupted, so broken down, so 19th century that we can't even discuss sensible ideas like a citizen's income. For example, if you were to try and discuss this with the Labour front bench at the moment, they would go, no, we can't talk about that. We've got to win these marginal constituencies and those kind of people, there's too much for them to take on board. And that, of course, means that we never get to discuss it, which means it can never happen because the debate never gets had, apart from on programmes like this.
OK, back to the Commons then. And now we hear from Julie Hilling, who's talking about the rise in people on long-term job seekers allowance, unemployed.
Julie Hilling.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the Prime Minister think that it's acceptable that since he came to office, the number of people claiming job seekers allowance for more than 2 years has increased by 390%?
What has happened since I became Prime Minister is the number of workless households has gone down to its lowest level. The number of households claiming benefit has gone down. And while we're at it, if she looks at what is actually happening in the Northwest, since the election, 18,000 more people in employment, 45,000 more people employed in the private sector. Unemployment has fallen in the Northwest by 7,000 since the election. And as I said, workless households down by 26,000. She should be talking up her region instead of talking it down.
What we're getting is two completely different views there, Tess. One saying that there's actually loads more people claiming these job seeker benefits, and then David Cameron saying a complete opposite, actually loads more families now off benefits. I mean, how on earth are we supposed to make sense of this, and what do you think is the reality?
Well, I think the reality is that people are getting less, whether they work or not, and that's what this government intends, that we spend less on those at the bottom of the pile, if you like. But actually, it's the people who work that we should feel most sorry for. I mean, these big firms, these big corporations, would be very pleased if people were willing to work for nothing. We'd go back to slavery, in other words. That's what they really would like. And the people who are in the lowest paid jobs are not very far off from being in that position. They can't earn enough money, however hard they work, to pay for a basically decent standard of living. And that is something we should all be ashamed of and we should all want to change.
Well, it's one of the reasons we're seeing the Red Cross coming in to try and help out people with food for the first time since World War II. Martin, what are your thoughts about this? What is the reality behind this? Because we're getting two completely different stories. You've got, you know, one on the one side, there's loads of people more claiming benefits. On the other side, Mr. Cameron saying loads of families less claiming benefits.
Well, one obvious point to make is that lots of people in work are claiming benefits. Many people in work like our claiming housing benefit, for example, which is why the housing benefit bill doesn't go down. So in other words, you get paid next to nothing if you are unemployed, and of course the long-term unemployed are increasing as a result of structural changes in the economy and so on. We may never go back to a full employment economy. That's why you need something like a citizen's income, because you've got to a capitalist system will not work well unless there's a redistribution mechanism built into it. That's what we learned at the end of World War II, and for a generation the capitalist system in the West was managed in a far-sighted way. The market was allowed to operate, but there was a big redistribution mechanism in place. In other words, a bit like an infant's birthday party, nobody's allowed to leave the party with no presents. But of course, what's happened is they want to turn the clock back to the 19th century, where basically wages can be forced down, living on benefits is impossible. But of course, ultimately, that doesn't work because there's no demand in the economy, and therefore it starts to topple over. All of the handouts to the people at the top does nothing to improve Britain's economic performance. They're simply invested in speculative ventures in foreign countries or in property bubbles. It does nothing at all to improve Britain's economic performance.
Yeah, it sounds pretty frightening. But anyway, one of the things we're discussing constantly on here is this economic crisis. Is it ever going to end? So Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week to ask you what you think.
When will the financial crisis end? And how will we know it has ended?
I don't actually think the financial crisis has ended, because people are still struggling to get mortgages and loans and everything like that.
Still struggling to get jobs.
Yeah. I was made redundant recently. I'm still doing temp work at the moment. The VAT is still 20%, so if things were good, then I would hope that it would go back down. When will it end? I don't know. How long is the peace of string, I think?
We've been in financial crisis for quite some time, at least 4 to 6 years in the UK, and I still feel like that it's slowly deteriorating, to be honest. I don't know when the end will be, but I know that we definitely need some help, and if the government have any influence to help us, they need to do something ASAP.
People are still struggling all over the country, so I think it's definitely going to get worse before it even starts to get better.
I suppose when the job market gets better and house prices stabilise, change of government, wait till the new government comes in, if there's going to be a change. They all kind of feather their own nests, so whichever government we have, it's always their benefit. It's never really for the people, I don't think. All the politicians just do as they're told, and they vote the way they're told to vote. They don't vote for the people that elect them. So.
And this economy in England is the best in another Europe country, because this is country care for people, for flat, helping. In Poland is no situation like that. Everybody must work very, very hard, and is no have more council flat. Only people must buy flat or rent flat. Many, many poor people live on the street.
I don't think it's got a clear end to it, so probably you're looking at a couple of years. But it does feel like we're coming out of it a little bit now, I'd say.
In 10 years' time, we will say we are out of the crisis. I think everyone has to tighten the belts and make the best of the situation. Just suffer with everybody else, I think.
Are some people doing well? Who are they?
Well, the only people who are doing well is the people with enough money that they can ride out the bad economy. I think everyone's struggling in some shape or form. Maybe more so medium incomes probably hit the worst, because obviously on the lower income they get more help from the government, and the people who earn much more, they're still probably eating three meals a day, where a lot of the medium families have to cut back their costs, and the only costs that they can really change is their food bills, because obviously, you know, if they've got a house or something, they have to pay the mortgage or they'll lose their house, or if they've got loans, they've got to, otherwise the repo men will come.
A good 80% of people within the UK are struggling, and I definitely feel that the government has more sort of activity to pursue to address this on a larger scale.
Well, it's the usual thing. It sounds like the fat cats, isn't it? It sounds like the bankers that are always still doing well. They seem to, they don't seem to be losing their jobs as like everybody else is. So I should think of finance is still doing good. That's kind of industry still doing well.
I guess the housing market seems to be picking up. So I guess house builders, they're probably doing quite well out of it quite now with all the government money they're probably going to be getting. So probably that industry and the construction industry in general, I guess.
Well, I think that some people did well. They made the money in the banks and things, and they've moved on to the next big thing, I guess.
Do you trust other mainstream media news?
Never have and never will. I think the media have a tendency to advocate certain issues that evidently distract the mass population from the real, true issues that we're dealing with. Predominantly, I get my news from internet sources. I like to have a multitude of different sources in regards to one particular issue, so I'll look and research different avenues of information to obtain the sort of facts and figures that I'm looking for.
I definitely follow what's on the news. Do I believe it all? Not entirely, because the media have a duty to sort of the government and to promote what they're doing and how they're doing it, but in terms of it feeding down to the people, there's no change really, you know.
I trust the BBC. They can be a bit biased occasionally, but yeah, I always watch BBC News.
No, I do not believe what they say in the paper.
Yes, to a certain extent, yeah. I guess you question everything these days. BBC mainly, yeah. BBC.
No, I wouldn't say I trust the news. I don't trust politicians. I don't have much trust, really. So I get news from the web, you know, the internet. But you have to take everything with a pinch of salt. You've got to make your own minds up. So just get the news from different perspectives and then make your own mind up. Never rely on what a newspaper's trying to push. They're sensationalised most things to sell papers, obviously.
All sorts of different views there. Quite a lot of people saying they don't really trust the news, which is a bit worrying. But anyway, what are your thoughts on that, Martin? It seems that there's quite a lot of people saying that actually, potentially anyway, you're right, it's going to go on for a long time, this financial crisis.
Well, that's if we're lucky, because the real problem is that what I fear, and I've said this on this programme every week for the last however long, the real problem is that there's going to be a further crash. The banking system is completely bankrupt. It's only being kept alive on artificial stimulation, essentially quantitative easing in the US and elsewhere, and that is coming to an end because there's a limit to what you can do with that.
What do you think, Tessa, but from what you just heard there?
Yeah, I agree with Martin. I think his analysis is sound. And that we are just marking time until we get the next financial crash. And we're not actually planning for that, and we should be. We should be trying to make sure that we can survive. Everybody can survive, but we're not. And so the poorest will suffer the most when it happens, but everybody will suffer. I've got a friend in Argentina, so they've been through this in Argentina. They've been through the situation where people with money in the bank had no access to that money. They had to use bartering systems in order to survive, to eat the basic necessities of life. That's what we're talking about. And the people who, like we've just heard on the Vox Pop, people who think about things more clearly, who get their news from a variety of different sources, are going to be better equipped to survive. The vast mass of people who don't do that, who haven't got the resources to do that, who are too busy working at these badly paid jobs, they're the ones who are really going to suffer, because they won't have enough to eat and they'll be in debt, which will be hanging over them and destroying their lives. So we should be scared about it. We should be organising to make sure that we can survive. Our food sources is probably the most important issue that we should be looking at in that context. But we're not doing any of it because we're not talking about it.
Another thing this week is the reshuffle. We've had a bit of a reshuffle, apparently, that is to say, with various people in the cabinet and the shadow cabinet moving around. The only thing I noticed from it, Tess, was the that we've got a couple of TV personalities, both on the Labour side and the Conservative side, women who've been chat show hosts on television, you know, in the breakfast TV and this kind of thing, daytime TV people, now being brought into government.
Yeah, well, I think that's trivialising government, to be honest. I mean, we're not on chat shows, or we shouldn't be, when we're actually making.
But they obviously think that
decisions.
These people are going to win votes and hearts and minds.
Yes, I think that is what they think. They also, they've obviously recognised that they haven't got enough women there, and that women are voters. They make up 50% of the voters. They're more likely to vote than men are. So they do have to do something about their image as a government, as being male and not taking notice of women, but they seem to think that women can't think for themselves if they think bringing in a few of these celebrities to government will, or shadow government, will help. I don't think it will. I think they made the wrong move.
Martin, have you noticed any big changes? I mean, I certainly haven't at the top. I mean, we've got the same sort of obviously no George Osborne wasn't reshuffled, Theresa May wasn't reshuffled as Home Secretary. None of the top jobs have moved around. Anything you've noticed about the reshuffle?
Well, if you look at the Labour Party reshuffle, I think it's quite interesting because Diane Abbott was removed. So, in other words, the Tory press suggesting that Miliband's moving to the left, removing her was a signal to them that he isn't. At the same time, he removed Jim Murphy and other so-called Blairites. And he's appointed people like Tristram Hunt, who's actually, of course, was a TV presenter and is an academic. I think he's consolidating his hold over the shadow cabinet. But I'm afraid they're still lacking in ambition from my point of view. But I mean, I recognise that the Labour Party is like a super tanker. It's not turned round in one go.
Another piece of news, the renewal of the First Great Western franchise. This is to run the London-Bristol-Swansea railway line. We won't have passengers cheering in the aisles on the 9:15 from London, says the Morning Star. If pass forms anything to go by, many of them will be standing all the way to Reading if it's a good night, and all the way to Swindon if it's not. For years, First Great Western's been rated amongst the worst of Britain's long-distance train operating companies by travellers, and yet they've had their franchise automatically extended without having to fight a battle over it. Now, you were talking about transport earlier, Tess. What do you make of this?
Well, obviously, it's the way things go. It's rubbish. We don't need it. We actually need our transport services to be in national hands. That's a basic. If we want decent services at a cost that we can afford, and safe services.
I noticed the East Coast Main Line, I think it is in government hands now, because the company that was running it went bankrupt and the government had to take it over, and it's now delivering quite a healthy profit and an excellent service, Martin.
Yeah, but it's going to be privatised. That is the implication. I mean, we should never have privatised the railways, and the Green Party, to their credit,
you can't,
for them to be renationalised.
You can't say that. Well, you can say it, but there's no point. How on earth would you actually renationalise
them if
you wanted to?
Really, if you regulate them hard enough, eventually they don't make a profit, and then you just buy them up for nothing, because that's what you could do with the energy utilities. Well, if you regulate them harder, if they're not making a profit, then you don't have to spend any money to buy a loss-making company, do you? That's how companies are nationalised in the first place. But you've got to have the backbone to do it, and I don't think we're going to get that backbone until the crisis really comes into its second phase. What the Labour Party is doing at the moment, I hope, is positioning itself for when that second phase comes, because then eventually all of these industries may just fall back into our hands once they're all making a loss.
Well, you can hope away. Next,
I'm just
story, UK Uncut protesters block roads in cities across England to oppose legal aid cuts. The campaigners are say plans aimed at saving £220 million from the Criminal Legal Aid Bill will block access to justice for millions of people. Well, we touched on this briefly last week. Michael Mansfield, the well-known defence lawyer, criminal lawyer, he was also on the Diana inquest. He was a lawyer on that inquest. He's had to close his chambers because he was making most of his money, which is actually not a lot, on legal aid. Tess?
Well, this is another attack on the poorest in society. It means that they can't get legal help to actually challenge what's happening to them. So again, it's another nail in the coffin of a fair society, as far as I can see. And we can't actually sustain this for very long, is my suspicion.
Martin, the government is saying, Ministry of Justice, we have one of the best legal professions in the world. It cannot close our eyes to the fact that about £2 billion legal aid is costing too much.
Well, we say it's costing too much, but we can give away the post office and we can go to war with Syria. When we want to spend money, we can, can't we? This is all ideological. And once the real crisis hits, then we will see.
Okay, Martin, thanks very much to our guest, Tess Green from the Green Party. After the news, we look at the health service.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.